Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with one of the nation's foremost experts on electrical power and energy, David Freeman, who has been inspecting the nuclear power plant at San Onofre, north of San Diego, which is leaking radiation and, in his opinion, should remain shut down. The former head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and the state energy czar who rescued California from the predations of Enron and Company, David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, An Energy Insider Shows How. Then we'll assess the upcoming talks this weekend between the P5 plus one and Iran, which might provide a diplomatic alternative to the impasse over Iran's nuclear program that threatens to lead to war and a global energy crisis. The co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, Dr. Trita Parsi, will discuss possible areas of agreement to avoid war, given that there is no agreement even among the P5 plus one itself on how to proceed. Then finally, we'll examine the fragile ceasefire that began today in Syria and discuss the stalemate between the Syrian rebels and the Assad regime, neither of whom can win in a civil war that is fast becoming a proxy war. Asla Bali, a professor at the UCLA School of Law who specializes in international human rights and the laws of war, joins us. She had an article in Wednesday's New York Times, "To Stop the Killing, Deal with Assad." Joining us now is David Freeman, who is a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. David Freeman is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, An Energy Insider Shows How. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And today, Southern California Edison announced that there has been more unusual wear has been found on tubing that carries radioactive water. And this is from unit number two generators, and there's a similar degradation in its sister reactor, unit three. And this latest disclosure has come in an ongoing series of disclosures and surrounding the mysteries of this plant's steam generators. What have you found out that's really going on here, David Freeman?
Well, together with Friends of the Earth, we retain probably the country's foremost expert on steam generators, Arne Gundersen. And he did a report, interestingly enough, 10 days ago, and his conclusion was that there was a fundamental change in the steam generators that were built to replace the old ones. This is an old plant. Let's put it in perspective. This power plant is 30 years old, which in power plant years is a lifetime. And it's a nuclear plant, which demands the most excellent engineering and workmanship of any technology I know, because it's, frankly, a radioactive factory. And if anything comes out, it's purely lethal in quantity, the equivalent of a bomb in terms of the impact that it can have. And we know that from Hiroshima. I mean, it's taken quite a few bombs to wipe out 20% of the country, which is what it did. So we're fooling around with really something a whole lot more lethal than dynamite. The steam generator, which is an important part of the plant, was worn out, so they had to replace it. They went, the Edison Company told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that we're just replacing the steam generator with another new one. And they have a process where if you're just replacing an old part, you don't have to go through a license amendment. So they went through the easy path where it was just kind of rubber stamped and no scrutiny was made. But these clever engineers at the Edison Company saw this as an opportunity to squeeze more power out of the plant. So they changed the design, which this is the largest steam generators in the world, I think. They're really big things, 65 feet high. And there was a, if you think of it in simple terms, if you assume this is a large tent, they had a pole in the middle that made it sturdy and not vibrate. They took the pole out of the design in order to squeeze more tubes in to get more power out of the plant. And as a result, you know, it's an exaggeration to say it this way, but these pipes began to dance like a hula dancer, and they rubbed up against each other. And in just operating this new steam generator for 18 months and 12 months in one unit, they found wear of 30% that you wouldn't expect in 15, 20 years. And they actually found the hole in one in unit three that was punctured. Well, Arnie identified these changes in the design, and he published a report which said that these are twins. An Edison company for many days, they had what I would call back in the Watergate days a limited hangout. The first day they said it was just steam that went out. The next day they said it's radioactive steam. Then they said, you know, it's just unit three. And now today, or rather on Tuesday, they had to admit that they found the same thinning in the tubes on unit three, that the similar thinning way beyond what you'd expect in a new unit. So they're twins. And now, you know, they then the next step is to waive the threat of blackouts. Now, blackout is a very serious thing in California. We went up against that in the year 2000 with Ken Lay and his gang. It faked power shortages to cause us to lose billions of dollars in electric rates. And so the fear of blackouts was waived in order to try to persuade the NRC, which is a watchdog, is really a puppy dog. And the chairman of the NRC came down here to the plant trying to placate Senator Boxer and Senator Feinstein that he was really serious. But he kept making a distinction between Units 2 and Unit 3. Now they've had to admit that they're twins. And so the next step, of course, is what did we do in 2001 when I was up there helping Gray Davis? We launched a major energy efficiency and conservation program, and we didn't have any blackouts in 2001. The loads were reduced through incentives and appeals to the public, and the ball game was over. And the Texas Raiders had to just go back home, and their game over.
Right, after stealing $40 billion, though.
Oh, yeah, but it, at least it ended. Another year, and it had been another 40. I'm not saying that that was a stellar performance, but it ended a few months after I got there, is all I can say. And in any event, what we have now is the public being given a choice between starting up a dangerous power plant and blackouts, and that's ridiculous. You know, a major efficiency program like we had in 2001 would keep the lights on, and that sucker, that nuclear plant, needs to stay down until we have really identified the causes and fix it. But the long-term prognosis is that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is giving out 20-year license extensions as though there were Valentines. Unless the public arouses itself in righteous anger and says, no, we face a 30-year plant living another 30 years right on an earthquake fault, right on the Pacific Ocean, that's already ailing and leaking, and where they cannot possibly evacuate the people there. There's 8 million people that live within the 50-mile zone, and if you drive down Highway 1 near that plant, you know, you just take any ordinary traffic jam day, and you know you can't get the people out of there. So nobody would even dream of building a nuclear plant there today, and it needs to stay down until they could get it fixed. And even if they get it fixed, it should be given an end date when its current license expires, which is still another 10 years. I don't know whether it could or should make it that long, but we got to know what's wrong with it before it goes back up. I mean, you know, We just had a shock. Another thing is it's designed for a 7.0 earthquake, and that's what Fukushima was designed for, and they had a 9.0, which is 60 times as great. People don't realize it goes up geometrically, and we've had 8-point-something earthquakes popping up all over the Pacific Rim in the last 48 hours. So it's just madness and insanity to think we're keeping that sucker running another 30 years or maybe even another 30 days. The other thing is back in the 70s and 80s when it was built, we really didn't have the technology to harness the sun and the wind or know about storage. We have it today. And if we decide now that that plant needs to be shut down either right now or at least when its license expires, we can start building the replacement power in an orderly way and in a cost-effective way and in a way that will start creating a whole bunch of additional green jobs that we badly need. So what's happened is the public has gone to sleep about nuclear power for the last 25 years because we didn't build any new ones, and the environmental community largely is focused on carbon. Well, I think we need to focus on carbon a whole lot more than we are. But the idea of substituting radioactive factories full of plutonium for carbon is also insane. And I just feel strongly that we got to bring an end to. There are two deadly forces on Earth that are threatening our grandchildren. One is climate change. The other is nuclear power. We have the answer for both. Efficiency and renewable energy. Like my granddaughter said to me, she says, "Dad, why are we trying to figure out how to make some energy differently when Mother Nature delivers it to us with the sun and the wind free of charge?" And it's a damn good question that the Southern California Edison Company needs to answer.
Well, what's key about these tubes is there are 10,000 of these alloy tubes in each of the plant's four steam generators that were just put in 2010 and 2011. As you said, Dave Freeman, the plant is licensed to go till 2022, 10 years from now. But all of a sudden, these new tubes have been breaking down at an alarming rate, and 321 of them have been heavily damaged, and they've been leaking. And of course, they are the key at the key point between the radioactive water and the non-radioactive water. And if they were to break, these tubes help cool the reactor core, and these breaks could compromise the cooling system and lead to a meltdown that we just saw recently in Japan and in Fukushima. So this is really key to it. So you're saying that they used the rubric of getting upgrading the plant with these new steam generators that they bought from the Japanese, but then they crammed in more tubes in order to extract more power out of it, and all of a sudden the plant starts to vibrate and the tubes start to rub up against each other and degrade rapidly. That's a summary, right?
Ian, you're rather good. You got it.
Okay, so
you described it quite well.
And the guy and
that's precisely it. And you know, just using plain English, they're operating a plant where the steam generator really hasn't been licensed properly.
Right.
And of course, we feel that there has to be local outrage at this because all politics is local, and if the local people are not afraid of the plant, I would like to find any one person listening to this broadcast who would like to have a nuclear plant located near their home. I don't think there is such a person.
Well, particularly one that's already had to be shut down because
The one that's leaking, 30 years old and leaking, no.
Right.
No. On an earthquake fault in an area where you can't get the people out of there, and the thing I haven't mentioned, there's 30 some odd years of highly radioactive nuclear trash piled up at that site, and of course the federal trash man was supposed to come and take it away, but he's never showed up because they haven't found a place to put it. You know why they haven't found a place to put it? Because there is no safe place on this earth. Let me just finish my point. Sure. I think this is, if you take it to be, I'll just put it this way. I think everybody would be in favor of birth control as far as these nuclear rods are concerned. How can we keep making more and more of them if we don't know where we're going to put them except to pile them up and bring them closer to closer on that site down there and make it more and more dangerous that something might happen? We need to get off of our nuclear arrogance and recognize that there's a lot, not only that we don't know, but there's a lot that we don't know we don't know. I mean, this is a radioactive monster that's sitting there, and it just takes perfect engineering to keep it from killing us. And my own view, and I've been on all sides of this nuclear issue in my life, but I did shut 8 of them down in the Tennessee Valley, and I buried one up in Sacramento in the 1990s. But in the past, I was lukewarm. I was just worried about the cost and worried a little bit. I went to Chernobyl in 1991. And let me tell you something, folks. When you see a monument with the names of villages on it, it does something to you. And then when you go out and talk to people who used to live there and they start crying when you talk about that there is nuclear power. And when you hand someone a Geiger counter and he hugs you because since I've been worried for 5 years whether the radioactive activity was still in the air, it becomes rather human to you. I would say that if we took a delegation over to Japan and came back, that they'd be talking like I'm talking.
Well, it's just
somebody calls me an alarmist. I say hell yes, because there's a lot to be alarmed about.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, David Freeman, again the former head of the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, Los Angeles DWP, and the California Energy Czar, who rescued the state from Enron and company, and you've been down there at San Onofre on Friday. Of course, the NRC chairman was there with Senator Feinstein, but also Senator Representative Daryl Issa, who represents that district, who's now.
Yeah, and they were kind of pushing the idea of, oh, we'll compromise this. We'll keep 3 down because they had the hole, and but 2 is very different. We're going to bring that up to meet the summer peaks. That was the line that they were peddling as of Friday, but the limited hangout that's coming out of this and company, they now reveal, oh, we've got the same problems in 2. So that idea, I would hope, is dead now, but who knows?
Well, but it's pretty clear that ISA is pressuring. He doesn't like JASCO of the NRC. You describe them as lapdogs instead of watchdogs, but they're not even, they're too zealous for ISA. He wants that plant back up and running.
Well, JASCO is just one person on a 5-person board. I've been on 5-person boards. Ian, the first thing you learn is you have to count to 3 or you don't have any impact. And JASCO does not have 3 votes. So he's trying, maybe as best he knows how, trying to please people on both sides of the aisle. They need to hear from local people. The congressman needs to hear from local people. The senators need to hear. The California Public Utility Commission needs to hear. And I think Jerry Brand needs to hear.
But what they need to hear is that this plant's already been jerry-rigged outside of specifications in order to cram more power out of it, and it's already breaking down when it's got a license to operate for another 10 years, and it's only been working for about a year, and the degradation is alarming. This is a serious matter. This thing sounds like it's an accident waiting to happen.
It's an accident that's already happened.
Well, Dave Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here and alerting us to this. Again, Again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who is the leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter and headed the New York Power, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and company. He is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence and Energy Insider Shows How. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about the possibilities of a peace deal with Iran. The talks begin on this weekend.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Trita Parsi.
Thank you for having me.
And we're on the eve of the P5+1 talks with Iran being held in Turkey, P5 being the permanent five at the United Nations and the plus one being Germany. This is, of course, a breakthrough in itself that talks are taking place. The head of Iran's National Security Council, Saeed Jalali, suggested on Wednesday that its representatives would present new initiatives. Do you have any sense of what new initiatives the Iranians may have up their sleeves?
No, and they've been very mum about that in the past as well. And oftentimes, the new initiatives have not been particularly new or particularly creative. They have put quite interesting proposals on the table in the past, but that was usually before the Ahmadinejad era, in which they had some relatively creative and at least intriguing proposals that were put on the table. At that time, though, however, the Bush administration was in power and there wasn't any interest in the U.S. side to pursue them. But the new proposals that have emerged out of Iran during the period of Ahmadinejad have neither been new nor particularly interesting for the other side.
Well, as you know, Senator Lieberman, McCain, and Graham are doing everything they can to frustrate these talks from even taking place. And the Lieberman amendment is going to probably be debated in the Senate next week. What's your understanding of why there is this constituency here in the United States to prevent even talks from taking place, whether or not these talks are successful?
Because there are those who have a belief that the compromise that is a likely compromise to come out of talks is not conducive to their interests. The Israelis, for instance, fear successful diplomacy more than they fear a collapse of the talks because they believe that the negotiations would lead to a situation in which Iran would have some limited enrichment capability, which in their view would turn it into a virtual nuclear power. It would shift the balance of power in the region, and it would reduce U.S.-Iran relation tensions without reducing Israeli-Iranian tensions, and in that sense, leave Israel abandoned in the region facing a hostile Iran. So there are elements both in the U.S., in Israel, and in Iran who actually prefer either the continuation of the status quo or even a confrontation to a resolution of this conflict.
And how far, in terms of that constituency, Trita Parsi, that you just mentioned inside Iran, we understand the constituents here in the United States, the loosely described as the neoconservatives. What is the constituency in Iran and how much is it, how close is it, or does it include the supreme leader?
The constituents in Iran is a bit different in the sense that you have both elements who are opposed to the idea or who are very fearful that if Iran negotiates with the West, it would be the beginning of the end of the regime. Then you have elements that are not necessarily ideologically opposed to talk, but who believe that whoever manages to resolve tensions with the U.S. would win a lot of political capital within Iranian society, and they don't want their political rivals to get that credit. So they have undermined and created obstacles to the solution in order to prevent their political rivals from getting the credit of resolving this issue.
But the Supreme Leader recently, and when he met with the Turkish leader a couple of weeks ago in Tehran, presumably the Turkish leader was laying the groundwork for these talks that are taking place in Turkey. The Supreme Leader said that it's un-Islamic to build an atomic bomb. What do you make of that?
Well, this is something that the Iranians have been saying for quite some time. And not too much attention has been given to that in the West in the past. I personally don't believe that such a statement, even if it carries some religious weight, which it does, is sufficient. I think the approach that needs to be done is to trust and verify, or perhaps even mistrust and verify. But the real key word here is verification. Making sure that there are verification processes in place that ensures that the Iranians simply cannot cheat and move towards weaponization without being caught well in time. Now, if they say that this is against their beliefs or interpretation of Islam, we can treat that as a positive and see if we can build something on it. And I think that's exactly what the administration is trying to do. But it can, in and of itself, never replace the verification to make sure that their words are matched by their actions.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Now, the clock is ticking in terms of the sanctions on Iran. They've never been this intense, and they're about to get fairly intense through the summer when the Europeans stop purchasing oil. Already, it's next to impossible for Iran to make international bank transactions and therefore get paid for their oil. But I guess the real issue here is once the Asian refineries, and you've written about this, Trita Parsi, once the Asian refineries shift away from Iranian oil, it's unlikely that they want to double the cost by shifting back to Iranian oil. And at that threshold is when things really get painful for Iran. They've always indicated defiance in the past. I mean, the only time I recall compromise, if you will, was when the Ayatollah Khamenei himself ended the Iran-Iraq war, and he referred to that as being like drinking poison. Do you think it's going to be another moment like that?
I don't believe it's going to be another moment like that because Iran is not in that weak of a position. I think there is a temptation and a very dangerous and counterproductive temptation on both sides to not really negotiate, but try to use the negotiations to impose on the other terms of capitulation. And neither side is in that type of a position of overcoming strength to be able to succeed with something like that. So I think it is a mistake, and I would be very dangerous to go to the table and have extensive demands, but not offer anything in return, particularly when it comes to sanctions. And I think in my own conversations with diplomats from the other P5 states, it's been quite clear that there is not an agreement within the P5 as to what position to take, what strategy to use, what tactics to employ. In fact, it's even reported today that the Russians have come out and said that there's not going to be a coordination meeting between the P5 because they don't agree on how to pursue these negotiations. And it really raises the question as to what is the purpose of going to the table now? We waited for so long, and there's no coordination between five. Is this going to be just a U.S.-Iran negotiation? What exactly is it going to be?
Well, I think that's a fair assumption. If the P5 being the permanent five at the UN Security Council, including Russia and China, it's unlikely that there'd be any agreement going in. And, you know, it's not a majority situation, is it, where the French, the British and the US and plus one Germany, it's not a question where they're going to be voting, right?
Certainly, but it's not just a division between the West and the P5 and the US is actually... and China and Russia, I'm sorry, there is a question of the French and the Europeans actually not being on the same page as the Americans. The French have taken a position, for instance, that is much closer to the positions taken by the Bush administration. So there is a division even at that level. I personally do have a suspicion that part of the reason why the Obama administration is very eager to move towards diplomacy right now, and I'm a person who's been for long on the track record, having long track record of supporting diplomacy, but it seems like a key motivating factor for the administration right now is because they need just some talks in order to push down oil prices, which will be of significant importance for their re-election bid. And that actually seems to be perhaps a stronger motivating factor right now and a driver of this than an actual strategy, tactic, some sort of a process that gives us confidence that this actually could lead to a solution.
Well, even short of getting some kind of agreement or some finding some way to lower the price of oil, and frankly, it's pretty clear to me from interviews I've done that the real driver of the price of oil is happening on Wall Street. It has nothing to do with the Middle East. In fact, the Saudi oil minister only a week ago said that the price of oil has no bearing on reality as far as he's concerned. But that aside, it would seem to me that there's an incentive in a way for both sides to sort of draw this thing out. Obama doesn't want anything to happen before the elections in any kind of military action, obviously. And presumably the Iranians are, if you're saying that the sanctions don't worry them, what's their incentive to...
No, sanctions actually do worry them quite a lot. They say that it doesn't, but I do believe that it does. But they have an incentive as well to go to the table because perhaps an interim deal can be found in which some of these sanctions would be delayed or would be lifted, and that would be beneficial to their short-term calculations. But also, if they don't come to the table, that would clearly create some other forms of problems. Both sides do have an interest in making sure that this doesn't lead to a military confrontation, and if there are ongoing talks, that's going to reduce the likelihood of the Israelis being able to engage in any unilateral bombings. So there is an interest in making sure that at least it works in the short term, but it doesn't seem to necessarily be driven by primarily of a desire to actually reach a deal right now, but because of other tactical and political reasons.
But surely and I would suspect that this might well happen in the negotiations, that the Iranians may tie inspection demands or demands to close down Fordo, the underground facility near Qom. Surely they will tie that to Israel's signature of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, plus the additional protocol. And if Israel doesn't sign these treaties, which is highly unlikely, Iran can say, well, why should we agree to anything?
Well, Iran is already a signatory to the NPT, so I don't think it is in a position to renegotiate its NPT membership.
Well, I was referring to the additional protocols.
It's quite clear that they're going to throw in Israel into the mix every once in a while because of many other reasons and other factors. But I don't think Iranians necessarily want the Israelis to suddenly come in and sign the NPT because that would probably mean that Israel would join the NPT for having states, and that would probably not be what the Iranians are desiring.
Sure, but just rhetorically, they're in the position to argue that they are acting to promote President Barack Obama's vision of a nuclear-free Middle East.
And it's not unlikely that they would make those arguments. I don't know how seriously they would push to have negotiations go in that direction, however. I mean, it's an argument that they would use to point out that there are some significant flaws and double standards in the Western position. But whether they would push for it as an actual outcome of the talks, I'm a bit skeptical about.
Well, just in closing, Trita Parsi, in some of the more recent interviews I've done, there's some alarming information that's come forth. I don't know whether you read the article in Foreign Policy about Israel's forging ties with Azerbaijan and the possibility of using air bases in Azerbaijan not to launch an attack on Iran from, but to make an air attack on Iran plausible, because the Israelis could refuel on their return leg, land and refuel after their bombing run. There's also, people have told me in the intelligence community, that it's also possible that Israel may have made arrangements in Iraqi Kurdistan to land and refuel on a return leg, because Up until now, it's often been said by military analysts that it would be extremely technically difficult for Israel to launch an attack at that distance and without in-flight refueling, which would be impossible. Do you think these factors that have been brought up, particularly by the article in Foreign Policy by Mark Harris, do you think they are something to be concerned about?
I wouldn't say that the story isn't true or is true, but I don't believe it is a game changer. I don't believe that even if that additional refueling capability would really change the picture that dramatically. I think what it does show, however, is that the Israelis, or let me put it this way, what it does show is that this would be a military confrontation that would be extremely difficult to contain. It would be having a high likelihood of expanding into areas that are quite problematic, and as a result, it would be very dangerous and unpredictable for the United States itself.
Well, even the very hawkish Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman said as much, that there'd be unforeseen and catastrophic consequences of an attack on a war with Iran.
Yes, it's very difficult for them to pretend otherwise.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you for having me.
Again, Dr. Trita Parsi is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and the author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Let's now take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the so-called ceasefire in Syria.
They got refrigerators full of blood. Another century spent pointing guns at anything that moves. Sometimes I worry that I've lost the plot. My twitching muscles tease my flipping thoughts. I never really dreamed of heaven much.
The plan keeps.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum, and she has an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times, To Stop the Killing, Deal with Assad. And welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thanks very much.
And apparently the killing has stopped in as much as this ceasefire that began this morning, Thursday, in Syria. So far there have been no major violations. There's, of course, a great deal of skepticism about it, including skepticism expressed by the head of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, who's, of course, the special delegate, special negotiator, Kofi Annan, the former head of the UN, is the special envoy who's brokered this deal. What's your sense of the deal and how much it's going to hold?
Well, I think that the skepticism about the ceasefire is entirely appropriate because the incentives to maintain a ceasefire are skewed at the moment on both sides. On the one side, the regime has not been cut off from arms suppliers' support by its major backers, Russia and Iran at this point. And as a result, its strategy of maximum repression in an effort to simply eliminate the at least armed elements of the opposition before they can pose a direct threat to the continuity of the regime is likely to continue. On the other hand, what you have is, for the most part, very large unarmed civilian mass demonstrations throughout Syria that are growing by the day. But in addition to that very large movement, you also have a much smaller group or set of groups that are armed resistance forces, and their ranks are also growing every day. And although they too are expected to hold to the ceasefire, they also face a skewed incentive scheme, because at the same time that the international community is asking them to commit to a ceasefire, they're also being told by Gulf sponsors, in particular Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that they will be supplied with arms, and by a wider set of actors, including the United States and other countries that attended the Friends of Syria conference in Istanbul, Turkey, that they will be given financial support, logistical support, and communication support. Under those circumstances, of course, the rebels are facing a moral hazard of being encouraged by the international community to resist a negotiated outcome or to resist a ceasefire, because they know that they would be able to gain external support. Both sides of that equation, we argue in our op-ed, are problematic insofar as both sides should be incentivized at this point to come to the table to negotiate. A ceasefire is a beginning point from which you can initiate some form of a political solution through negotiations and transition. But that requires that both sides understand that they don't have a violent alternative to that arrangement. And that means bringing Russia and Iran to the table and incentivizing them to communicate to the Assad regime that it's going to get cut off unless it cooperates in the international process. And similarly, on the other side, U.S. and Gulf allies need to communicate the same message to armed groups operating in resistance to the Assad government. Otherwise, you just have a formula for escalating violence on both sides. A ceasefire will hold, it will be tenuous, it will be broken under disputed circumstances, and both sides will continue to experience incentives to resume fighting.
Well, it seems, Asda Bali, that you mentioned in your article in the Wednesday's New York Times, to stop the killing, deal with Assad, the dangers of this becoming a proxy war at the expense of the Syrian people. It may well already be that, given the alignment of the Saudis in the Gulf and the West on one side and the Iranians and, I guess, people like Hugo Chavez on the other. The long and the short of it is a stalemate, isn't it, in the sense that the rebels, even if they're going to be paid by the Saudis and perhaps even armed by the Saudis, they're not going to advance much from the situation they're in now, but they have the capacity for a long, long-term guerrilla war to paralyze that country. And conversely, on the government side, they can't quell all of the rebellion and they can't control all of the country, but they've got Russian arms and enough support. And as I mentioned, Hugo Chavez is providing them with oil and diesel. So this is a genuine stalemate, isn't it? Neither side can win, it would seem.
Yes, in fact, it's a microcosm of the broader stalemate of the competition that's taking place in the region now for spheres of influence, as between Iran and countries that are supporting Iran and view Iran, Syria, et cetera, as their toehold in the region, and countries that support the alternative to that alliance, which is, you know, equally a set of quite immoderate actors, including Saudi Arabia. So you have pitted on two sides, both in the region as a whole and then in the microcosm of Syria, a set of actors, neither of which at this point is in a position to prevail directly. I agree with that. The worst case scenario in Syria is one in which essentially the country gets cut off, increasingly isolated, and while that isolation is taking place, which is essentially cutting off also the civilian population from a variety of kinds of support they might seek, you have arms flowing into the country on both sides at a rather rapid clip, which will simply fuel and escalate the existing violence. We saw something like this happen in Bosnia in the 1990s, when technically there was an arms embargo, but in fact, both on the side of the Serbs and on the side of the Bosnian Muslims, both sides were getting supply and rearmament, and essentially what happened is that the conflict and the fighting escalated and escalated. That is not obviously a workable solution. At the end of the day, the way in which the Bosnia crisis was concluded was at the negotiating table through a political solution. And however, less than perfect that solution at Dayton might have been, it was certainly an improvement over the level of killing that we saw in Bosnia. Syria has not reached that point yet. In 14 months, something on the order of 10,000 people being killed is disastrously heavy toll, but not comparable to what we might see if you had a really full civil war. So I think we need to really keep a focus on the cost that is going to be imposed. And that begins with the civilian population in Syria. I agree entirely that they are, in fact, the ones that are paying the price for this, what appears to be shaping up as a proxy war. But it may not just be restricted to the Syrian civilian population, because to the extent that this takes on very clearly sectarian hues, and it appears to be doing so with not just Saudi and Qatar, but also Turkey playing a sectarian role, Sunni actors in Iraq playing a sectarian role, and on the other side, Shi'i community in both Iraq and Lebanon, and of course Iran and so forth. This has the possibility of destabilizing what are already quite fragile balances of sectarian interest in neighboring countries, namely Lebanon and Iraq. And if we saw a return to full-fledged sectarian conflict in Iraq or a return to the same in Lebanon, the numbers of civilians that would now be endangered would be multiplied manyfold. So the risks associated with not finding a political solution at this point are extremely high, and as a result, it's a very serious moment for the international community to confront that there is that really what we've produced is an extremely negative set of incentive schemes for both sides in this conflict. And if we want to de-escalate the violence, it means a coordinated effort. Now, one thing that's worth pointing out is, to the extent that this is a regional proxy war, it's basically over the stakes of the sort of fate of Iran as a regional player. Iran has its backers who view Iran as their position of strength in the Middle East, and of course it has its opponents ranging from other Gulf Arab states to Israel. And, of course, the already tense relationship between Iran and the United States. But I think it's worth noting that to the extent that the Syrian conflict is really a proxy for or an extension of a broader regional conflict around Iran, one has to really look at the stakes in this conflict seriously and what needs to be brought to the table to be negotiated. Particularly, what I mean by this is Iran and Russia have no reason to put genuine pressure on their ally in Syria at this point, if that means simply losing an aspect of their own sphere of influence in the region at their expense coming up with a political solution that consolidates the position of their adversaries regionally. No set of parties are likely to sign up for that kind of a geostrategic calculation. Instead, in order to get the Russians and the Iranians to be prepared to make a concession on their sphere of influence in the region, one has to offer something in return that's worth negotiating over from their perspective. And that means opening up the file and becoming much more serious about a negotiated track around the Iran problem, which is, of course, the nuclear file, but also the questions of Iran's security concerns, Israeli dimension, and so forth. Those are elements that are central, basically, to resolving what's happening in Syria today, because unless they're confronted as a really relevant dimension of what lies behind the escalation of conflict in Syria, any political solution is going to be unlikely to hold.
Again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was a coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum and had an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times to stop the killing, deal with Assad. So you were saying that both sides are locked in situations with negative incentives. What possible positive incentives could be brought to the table?
So, I mean, if we, and by we, I mean the international community, the West, powers that wish to see a resolution in Syria that involves regime transition, but hopefully one that's negotiated as opposed to a forcible overthrow, which will likely yield civil war conditions in Syria. So a negotiated transition that sees the departure of Assad under, some agreed political scheme. Those who support that outcome need to understand that in order to get Russia and Iran to support that outcome, we're asking them to give up one of their allies, a regime that's in an alliance with them, and that will very likely be replaced by another set of actors that are more palatable both to the domestic population that has risen up against this regime and to powers in the region that feel that the Syrians represent an adversary, by which I mean the Gulf Arab countries, Israel, the United States, and so forth. So if we're going to end up with a regime more friendly to those powers and less friendly to Russia and Iran, and we want Russia and Iran to sign up for that deal, we're going to have to understand that that means bringing something to the table that's desirable for Russia and Iran. So, for example, in the Russian case, an example would be an assured access to the warm water Mediterranean port of Tartus, which is currently a place where Russia stations its a fleet of it, because it doesn't have direct access to the Mediterranean from the Black Sea without having to travel through the Turkish Straits. On the Iranian side, obviously, we are now at a point where we have tightened sanctions to the maximum level with respect to Iran over the nuclear program, but have initiated only, at best, half-hearted steps towards negotiation against the backdrop of a systematic drumbeat of war and military threats to engage in a unilateral attack against Iranian facilities. Lowering the temperature on that set of confrontations over the Iranian nuclear file, reinitiating meaningful negotiating tracks, political engagement, and so forth with Iran would give Iran a reason to feel less insecure and more able to, you know, cooperate with the international community on one side, where it's in fact being engaged cooperatively on the other side. So I think it means getting serious about putting the Iranian question centrally on the table and offering the Iranians a meaningful negotiating framework. Short of that, I really can't see how Russia and Iran are going to have the incentive to join an international strategy that involves the exit of their ally. And if they don't, then that ally is going to carry on being supplied with the means to continue the conflict. And that's a catastrophe for lots of reasons. The Syrian civilian population is my principal concern, but from the U.S. perspective, just strategically and in terms of national security, the potential to destabilize very serious interests that the United States has in Turkey, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Jordan, and in Israel also looms over this conflict. And so it's not simply that Syrian civilians are to be sacrificed for us, meaning the international community as a whole, playing out their proxy conflicts. It's not just a question of the Syrian civilian population. That, to my mind, is the most important priority, protecting that vulnerable population, which is now caught in crossfire between two sets of forces that have resorted to arms. But
there's no symmetry between the. Sorry to interrupt you, but there's no symmetry between the armed sides.
Of course, there's no symmetry between the armed sides. That's absolutely true. Just as in Iraq, there was no symmetry between the amassing of very serious military forces under the coalition and an insurgency. But the capacity of insurgents to wreak havoc on civilian populations is very high. So I'm not suggesting in any way that the battle is somehow even between Assad's forces and the insurgents. The insurgents, the armed resistance, is at a very great disadvantage. But parties that are at a very great disadvantage in that way also have the possibility of relying on asymmetric tactics, often at the expense of civilian populations.
Sure. So, Aslam Ali, why then, if this is the only way that there has to be a compromise, certainly the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been quite forthright in her skepticism, saying that, first of all, she said that today that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad would have to go, and she said the Annan plan is not a menu of options, it's a set of obligations. So that's been going on for some time. The U.S. has been saying he has to go, he will go. They've been saying that. There's no indications that he is. You're suggesting, I think by implication, that any kind of deal would have to include some kind of government or coalition government that includes Assad. The indications from the U.S. are that that's a non-starter.
I wouldn't say that it includes Assad. I think it's basically unfortunate that the U.S. has taken that position, not because I think Bashar al-Assad should remain, but rather because it creates a no-exit scenario in which it basically incentivizes the regime to dig in, because they're being told that any outcome is going to involve their elimination as a regime, and that's not a helpful way to engage in negotiation, as we've seen in multiple other contexts. A blueprint for the kind of political solution, negotiated transition, would be what happened in Yemen, which, again, is suboptimal, certainly. The best-case scenario for Yemen would have been elimination of the Saleh regime as a whole, not just the removal of Saleh himself, but also the removal of his deputies and others who have been implicated in the kind of corrupt autocratic rule that he has been associated with. That's not what happened in Yemen. What happened in Yemen instead is, in exchange for ending the violence on the part of the government, Saleh was compelled to step down by his regional allies, and his deputy took over in a transitional context as Yemen then moves in the direction of a new electoral strategy. That's suboptimal. A better outcome would have been immediately turning to new elections and replacing all of these regime figures. The same thing could be said of Egypt, where now we're talking about Omar Suleiman potentially being considered as a presidential candidate, which would represent the return of the Mubarak regime rather than transition. But these are scenarios that have been contemplated elsewhere, largely to avoid the levels of violence and instability that we now see in Syria. That's the kind of model. Now, in Yemen, it was possible because the allies of Saleh in Yemen, we were in fact on that side, and we ourselves had an incentive to see Saleh transition in a way that retained some continuity with that regime and with our joint interest with them, particularly related to the war on terror, but also the Gulf Cooperation Council's interests and so forth. In this instance, we're on the other side, and we imagine that we have something to gain from the rapid and immediate exit of Assad. And as a result, we've taken much more of the stance that was taken towards Gaddafi, must go, has to go, held accountable, and so forth. None of these things are likely to produce a negotiated political solution. And that should be the priority. In other words, prioritizing peace at this moment first, an end to the violence because of humanitarian considerations, and then turning to questions of what kind of mechanisms of accountability might we have in place for a Saleh, for a Mubarak, for a Ben Ali. Those kinds of questions come second. Unfortunately, when they don't, when we prioritize that and we insist on sending a message to the regime that it has no exit option at all, then what we see is what happened in Libya, which is a rapid escalation of the conflict and then ultimately a collapse of institutions, which, of course, I mean, is also a suboptimal outcome.
Well, it's even worse with Syria, that scenario, because they have vast chemical and biological arsenals. So you could end up with a Somalia on the Mediterranean. But just in closing, Asla Bali, Turkey is obviously playing a major role here, having hosted the Friends of Syria conference. Turkish leader, Prime Minister Erdogan, was in Tehran just, a week ago, where he met with the Supreme Leader, apparently, assuming he was laying the groundwork for this meeting that's taking place over the weekend in Turkey involving the P5, the permanent five heads of the UN Security Council, plus Germany and Iran. My assumption is that some of the stuff that you're talking about that needs to be done in terms of incentivizing both the Russians and the Iranians, it sounds like the Turkish leader who's brokering these talks has already discussed this stuff, surely.
I hope that's right. I mean, obviously, this would be behind the scenes. That wasn't officially what was discussed. Very much the same can be said of today's meeting between Clinton and Lavrov. Again, one hopes that the discussion behind the scenes was one that addressed Russian concerns and, in the case of Iran, Iranian concerns, and that put Syria front and center and not just the, other ancillary questions associated with the P5+1 or EU3+3 negotiations with Iran. So I hope you're right. Having said that, Turkey has also made some other kinds of alarming moves in the last week, including speaking much more seriously about the safe zones or humanitarian corridor idea, which, to be clear, is an idea of having foreign troops, either Turkish or other, on Syrian soil, maintaining a particular area outside of the Syrian regime's control in order to protect civilians in that area. Going down that route of humanitarian corridors, I mean, essentially we have a safe zone and humanitarian corridor now. It's just on the Turkish side of the border. But when we talk about placing it on the Syrian side of the border, what we're discussing is something that, very likely would be understood to be a serious escalation of the conflict.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Asla Bali.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Asla Bali. She's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She had an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times to stop the killing, deal with Assad. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by